This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Inside Voices. I'm Kevin T. Porter. My guest today is Travis McElroy. Okay, a little background. Travis McElroy is a performer who in 2010 started a podcast with his brother Justin and his brother Griffin called My Brother, My Brother and Me, a comedy advice show in which the hosts are trying desperately to not give advice the whole time. It is wacky, goofy, very funny, and the lifelong relationship of three boys who like and love each other is fundamental to its deep and wide appeal. Over time, it's amassed a surprisingly diverse audience. It spawned a TV adaptation on CISO, RIP CISO, and Travis would go on to host and produce no less than 12 podcasts over the next decade, although now he's whittled it down to a more manageable 3. In addition to Mabim Bam, which is short for My Brother and Me, he hosts Schmanners, a podcast about etiquette with his wife Teresa McElroy, and The Adventure Zone, a wildly successful Dungeons & Dragons podcast the McElroy brothers write and perform with their father Clint. His brothers also have several ongoing podcasts, respectively. And there's a way in which Travis's work life is pretty enviable. He's in business with his family, making a product a great number of people adore. And he gets to do all this without having to live in New York or LA. Travis has made a home with his family in Cincinnati, the city he didn't have to live in but wanted to. And the scrappy audio empire the McElroys have stumbled into has worked and connected with audiences in a way that feels fully irreplicable. It's the precedent that shouldn't be referenced, the kismet that could not be concocted. It's tempting to look at them and think that starting a podcast with your family, essentially about nothing, is a rocket ship to success, but I think that could only work the one time. And they are the one time it could work. So now let's hear the irreplicable Travis McElroy describe his own voice.
Weird. Is that descriptive enough? Travis McElroy has a weird voice.
Just weird.
Yeah.
Weird can mean so many different things, though. What does that mean for you?
No, because the thing is I have felt both ways about my voice. Is the thing. It's like weird in two ways of weird bad and weird good. Weird unique. I have a unique voice. I have a... Not anymore, but for a long, long time, hated it. So, bad, disgusting, gross, off-putting.
That was the weird bad.
Yeah.
And that was that pre-podcasting, or was that, throughout podcasting as well?
100%. I mean, even, during podcasting. I this is a big thing to drop right here at the beginning, Kev, but the thing is this by doing, character voices in Adventure Zone... that I started to like my voice again, hearing it as a character and not as myself, that made me like it. And editing podcasts and hearing my voice over and over and over again, got me kind of in it, inured to it. So it didn't bother me as much anymore.
You built up a Travis McElroy voice immunity for yourself.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, because the thing is a lot of the problem when I was a kid came from the voice I heard in my head was this deep, cool, buttery, smooth, awesome voice. And then I'd hear it in a recording and be can I curse,
yeah,
Kevin? I'd be fuck, what is this voice? This isn't my voice, I hate this. And so whether it was answering machine messages or especially like with singing, because I did a lot of like musical theater when I was a kid, and like I'd watch the like videos of it later and be like, this is not how I thought I sounded in this show. And like then doing like just like talking into a microphone and like recording that whenever my brothers and I would like, we had, you know, all the little like cassette recorder things, toys and stuff, and I play with that, and I'm just like, I hate my voice. People also would tell me like that my voice was weird. Justin, and I do not hold this against him now, and neither should anybody listening, but Justin, when we were far younger, like I was probably like 16 or 17, told me that I sounded like I had swallowed a handful of gravel and I got stuck halfway down my throat. Yeah, but not like in a cool gravelly voice kind of way, but just like in a, your voice is weird, which is why it's always so weird to me when people are like, I can't tell the brothers' voices apart. When it's like, really? Because like, I think my voice sounds way different from Justin and Griffin's. But now we're just talking about like sound quality. If we're talking about the voice in general, I was in speech therapy from like 7 years old to like high school.
Why'd you need it?
I had a bad sibilance, my S's and Z's. I had a lazy tongue. I have a very big tongue, and it would like I could not keep it behind my teeth. So, like, I had problems with, like, S and sh and z and th sounds and th sounds.
What did those sound like before the voice lessons?
I mean, it was, like, eths and ts, and, like, there was a little bit of that. But mostly, it was also, like, I mumbled a lot. Like, I did not enunciate well. And, like, the same year I started going to speech therapy was the same year I started the Talented and Gifted Smart Kids program at my school and started wearing glasses and got diagnosed with ADD. So, like, they all in second grade. So it's just like, hey, what a cool year for you, you cool dude. And that's also the year I started doing musical theater, which was cool. That was another thing that, like, I did not like about my voice. And even now, podcasting has helped with this a lot, but when I, like, get tired, I will mumble again and I will not enunciate and it will be like hard to understand. And so like there was that. And then in addition to that, I was born and raised in West Virginia. I lived in West Virginia for 18 years before I went to school and went to like urban, fancy Oklahoma. So I had like a West Virginia accent, you know, for a long time until I started. I don't know if it's because of musical theater or because of speech therapy, but that I started like distancing myself from the accent. So it was like I had a kind of weird voice mixed with enunciation problems mixed with this like strong country accent, and it was like a lot of like, this is not a good radio voice. In college I was taking a professional like prep work theater class. It had a better name than that, but part of the class is like we would do mock auditions, and so like we'd be told what the audition was for. You prepare two pieces, you come in and do them for the class, right? And then the teacher would like decide if you got the call back or not, basically. And one of the assignments was like voiceover, like I don't remember if it was like cartoon or commercial or what, but I just didn't do it. I like came in and said like, oh, I haven't prepared anything. And he was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I just didn't do it. And he was like, okay. So then after class, he's like, why didn't you do it? And I was like, I have a terrible voice. No one is ever going to hire me for my voice. Like, I am a character actor. I am a comedic actor. Like, I sell myself with, like, physicality and facial expressions and all of that. Not my voice. And now that's very ironic, considering that I am well known for using my voice.
Yeah, I'm majority known for a voice, more so than visually.
Yeah, indeed. There are still people who, when I post a picture or something, will be like, I had no idea what you look like.
And that's strange, too. Do you get the thing that a lot of people get where it's like, oh, I pictured you looking much differently than what you sounded like?
Yeah, and the weird thing is like, whenever I press that, which I don't normally, but when I'm like, what did you think I'd look like? They don't have an answer. It's just, I think actually now that I've like dyed my hair and like pierced my ears and, you know, I think I'm more of what people picture when they picture it. You know what I mean? Another part of it, maybe the title is a flamboyant voice, because like that's the thing of like for a long time, because of like my exuberance and maybe part of it was the lisping, because that is an unfortunate stereotype, that there were plenty of people in West Virginia and Oklahoma who were like, you're gay, right? Not in like a necessarily judgmental way, so much as it was just like a factor. Like, just this is a true thing about you, correct? Like, I remember one time somebody, after we started doing Schmanners, my wife and I doing Schmanners, somebody tweeted at Teresa, like, I hate to tell you this, but I think your husband is gay because of how he sounds. And it's like, oh, cool. Wow, that's really small-minded and bigoted of you. Cool, cool.
You would think Teresa would be amongst the first people to know if you were actually gay.
Right, yeah. I mean, she'd only been with me like 8 years at that point.
That is a common thing. That's got to be so generational, too. There's a couple of things that you've said that have struck me as like particularly generational, one of which is the fact that growing up, I don't think we had a lot of models voice-wise for enunciating and not mumbling. It feels like so many of the things that are propped up is like cool, aspirational, or even maybe even sometimes like heroic or whatever the protagonist is. You don't think of someone doing this. Like, it's not like we adored Rex Harrison as a little 12-year-old in middle school. Whereas I feel like now, because of the way media works and because that's so disseminated, that might be different. So
yeah, I think a lot of it also had to do with like maybe because of the ADD, like I talked so fast, like I didn't think about what I was saying, and so I would talk so quickly that it's like I did not take the time. And it actually has been, I talk a lot about all like my different coping mechanisms, though that's a weird way to put it, but it's a good explanation for it. For like dealing with ADD and stuff. And one of them I found was like, by thinking about my diction, I slowed down the speed at which I talked and it gave my brain time to catch up. So like when I'm recording, I'm really trying to think about like tongue placement and like how I sound so that it's giving me time to like catch up on it, you know what I mean? And not get too far ahead of myself.
Yeah, do you feel like that's actually made you more thoughtful in some ways because of that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's given me better word choice. But once again, it's when I think about it. That's the other thing is like, this is something I worry about now, not to get too serious for a second. But now with like BB and Dot, you know, kids model their parents. Yeah, my daughter's kids model after their parents. And I'm so worried, like, I'll be sitting around, you know, speaking lazily. And it's like, are they going to pick it? Because, like, already BB does, like, the, like, R and W substitutions, which is, like, really common for kids. Which is, like, instead of saying, I need a rest, you would say, I need a West. Right?
And really it's adorable, common. So you don't mind it at the time.
Well, it is adorable. And that's honestly one of the problems with like getting kids to speak correctly is like a lot of the stuff is adorable. And so like, for example, the other day she was trying to say hospital and she kept saying like hospital or something. And like, it was cute, but like knowing how bad Teresa and I were like, hospital. She's like, yeah, hospital. And we're like, no, hospital. And it's like, I feel like an asshole right now. Like, no, say it right. But like, I know that if I don't do that, then like, how long are you going to keep saying it incorrectly? And yeah, I don't want you to start school, you know, in hopefully 6 months or so and have the teacher be like, what did you say? Like, I want you to say the right words.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you said that kind of strikes me as something tied to a particular time, maybe, hopefully, historically, is the idea of getting misoriented, for the way you talk and people assuming certain things about your sexuality because of your voice. And again, I think it's one of those things where it's just like an absence of models for if every depiction you see of a queer person, they talk in a particular way or like particular things, then of course it would be natural. And even when people did assume it in ways that were not unkind, it would be natural for people to think a certain thing and just make assumptions, because I feel like that's something even I've gone through. That's something I've even gone through in front of you, if you'll recall,
a couple
years ago, where someone did just like fully assume. And, you know, maybe that was a voice thing and maybe there were just like other aesthetic things tied into that.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do, because like I've talked about this with people a lot, is like it has to do with coding, right? Is like this thing of like for a long time, characters were coded, like you would code them as queer, right? Instead of saying this character is gay or this is she's a lesbian or whatever.
Yeah, right? Like most of the Disney animated canon, all the villains are somewhat coded. Yeah.
They would code them in some way because they like didn't think they could just say like this person is gay, right? And so they would code them. So it's like, oh yeah, clearly that character is gay, right? And so they needed like shorthand to like make that clear. And so unfortunately, it's like if they wanted to code a character as gay, they would make him really flamboyant and like really kind of like floppy hands and lispy and stuff. And it's like, okay, but and the thing is it's not that there aren't, you know, gay guys like that, but there are also plenty of straight guys like that. And there are plenty of women like that. Like there are plenty of non-binary people like that. Like it has nothing to do. It was just like an easy way to like shorthand, like, you get it, right? You understand what we're saying. And so for like a little kid like me, where it's like, literally, I sounded like this, Kevin. Hey, father, what are you doing? It was like the, like it was a lot. We have home videos of me as a kid and it's like, you can barely understand. Like I cannot even accurately recreate like my speech impediment now because of like how hard I've worked to do it, like to not do it. And it's like also for the same reason I'm not very good at, actually my like ask anyone, I am not good at recreating an accurate West Virginia accent. Like I have these friends who are like from Boston and Philadelphia and stuff, and they can just like drop into their old like say like do your Philadelphia accent and they'll just like drop into it, and I'm like, impressive. I cannot do that.
Yeah, it's almost blocked out for you. Yeah,
right. I've worked so hard to get this voice,
and it's one of those things too that feels culturally loaded in terms of the way that people perceive and assume certain things about people who have Southern accents too.
Right.
Like,
right.
Like, cause that's, you know, and it's different from like queer coding, but that does, and that did feel coded in a different way in a lot of media growing up too, where like, if you want to, especially even in things like comedy sketch shows or the Carol Burnett show or something like that, if you want to tell an audience that someone is kind of dumb or not that right. smart, a very easy way to get there is with a Southern accent.
Well, and it also has to do with identity. You know, like if you talk to somebody who's originally from Boston, right, or originally from Philadelphia, or originally from New York, originally from Chicago, like these places where you think like, I hear that accent and I know where they're from, right? There is a certain pride that like comes up, like, you know, there's like my friends that are from Philadelphia are very proud that they're from Philadelphia. Like ask Hal Loveland about being from Philadelphia sometime and he'll talk your ear off. Right. And so that wasn't necessarily true growing up in West Virginia. Like the identity that people were proud of there was not a good identity to be proud of. Right. There wasn't like this West Virginia pride because of how great, you know, that you believed the city. Like it was like the people with, you know, the Confederate flag in which, let me just clear this up, folks, as a born and raised West Virginian, West Virginia exists purely to join the Union. It is why the state exists. People hanging up Confederate flags is the most ridiculous, dumbass thing. But that was like the identity that people from West Virginia showed pride in, which sucks because that was like not, I like that was not something I saw in my town growing up. Like I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia, and it wasn't like Confederate flags hanging from everybody's porches or whatever. Now, having been removed for many years, I do feel a sense of pride from being from there because of how beautiful it is and like learning about the history of it and stuff. But it wasn't like, I'm proud of my accent. I remember once in college, I was auditioning for a guest director. And after I like did my monologue, she goes, are you from West Virginia? And I was like, yeah, how'd you know that? And she's like, I can hear it in your voice. And I was horrified. I was like, I was embarrassed. It was such a weird thing that she was just like, I have a great ear for accents. And I was like, okay. But like, it really threw me off.
So that was kind of the weird bad part of your voice. When did your voice start to feel, or at least sound to you, to be weird good?
So when we recorded the first episode of My Brother, My Brother and Me, I was very nervous.
What year was this?
This was 2010. April of 2010. Justin and Griffin had already been doing the Joystick podcast for Joystick, the website that they, you know, wrote about video games for. And so Justin was like, we'll do this podcast. And a combination of having not done it before and hating my voice. And so I was very nervous. And whether he meant to do this or not, I still do not know. But then Justin said, like, this is going to be a test episode. So we'll just record and see how it goes before we record an actual episode. And I was like, okay, cool. So we just recorded. I didn't think about it. I wasn't nervous. And then we finished and he was like, okay, that was good. We'll publish it. And I was like, ooh. So like then that episode came out and like people listened to it and said they liked it. So like that started to build my confidence. And at the same time that I got that, that we started doing My Brother and Me, which I now think of as a job, I got another job working at the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company. And I got hired as their master carpenter at the time and eventually became technical director. But I also acted in a lot of stuff, too. And so I, you know, got to speak on stage and stuff as well, including like getting to do complete works of William Shakespeare Abridged, which is one of my favorite comedies ever. It's very dumb and I have a lot of fun doing it. But like doing stuff on stage where I actually got to like use my voice and working at a Shakespeare company and like, you know, doing exercises and stuff and warming up my instrument.
What were some of those warm-ups? I'm always curious with that stuff.
About warm-ups?
Yeah.
I did a lot of sibilance shit, you know? I slit the sheet I slit, and on the slitted sheet I sit. A lot of that stuff. When I was in college, I hated, like, my voice and diction teacher, who I now love and is a very dear woman, but at the time, it was like straight out of a movie where like the professor, the person you've been sent to, your whatever, your spiritual advisor is like, it's like Mr. Miyagi having you do like the wax on, wax off, and you're like, I'm supposed to be learning karate, and then he goes to punch you and you do it and you're like, what? Because she was like, now we're all going to be seaweed and move around. I'm like, I'm not fucking, how is this going to help me act? I'm not fucking, unless I'm acting in Little Mermaid, what are you talking about? And it was like, I just didn't want to relax. I didn't. And so like, for example, like I took voice and diction 1 and 2, which were the only ones we were required to take. And like voice and diction 3 was like accent work. And I was like, no, thank you. And like, now I'm kicking myself. I was like, why the fuck didn't I take accent work? And it was because I didn't think I'd use it. And which of course would. So I, you know, got back to like working on projecting and being heard to the back of the theater and that kind of stuff. And like speaking in very, like when you're doing Shakespeare, it's very specific language. And it's very like how, where the, I mean, it's the whole thing with iambic pentameter, right? You're thinking about emphasis and you're thinking about how you're breaking down the syllables and punctuation and all that stuff. So like that was very good for me to think about in terms of like that. And as you said, seeing it modeled in these professional actors that I very much respected who were speaking that way. And like, it was an environment in which even when we were just having like production meetings, right, we were all speaking very, we were all soaking it in. And so then we started doing more and more My Brother and Me, started doing live shows with it. And that was another thing of like, I want to be understood. After a while, then I started doing other podcasts and ranging from, let me see how many I can remember. In Case of Emergency, Bunker Buddies. I want to say the next one was Trends Like These. And then Interrobang with Travis and Tybee. Then Schmanners. Then The Kind Rewind, I think, with me and Teresa. And then Run, a Doctor Who fan cast. And also in there was Surprisingly Nice, that I did with Hal Lublin. We only did a couple episodes of that, but I really like that one. Maybe I'll bring that back. I already do too many. And let's see. Also, then there's, of course, Adventure Zone. The McRoy brothers will be in Trolls World Tour and Till Death Do Us Blart. And so I was using my voice a lot. There was a time, not anymore, but there was a time where I was putting out 28 episodes of something a month. So, like, a lot. Too much.
What was the rationale behind that? Because you start My Brother and Me, and it kind of has the trajectory that you might expect of like starting a little soft and then gaining a following slowly over time with a few huge inflection points. But then as far as like diversifying into all these other shows, what was kind of the engine of rationale driving that?
So we were doing My Brother and Me, and I can never quite remember the timing. I have to always like compare calendars, but I think we started doing Adventure Zone like just before I moved to Los Angeles. But anyway, so I moved to Los Angeles with my wife, then wife. We just got married. I got there, and so I had the like recurring like money I was making off of my brother and me as like kind of my steady paycheck, but it really wasn't enough to move to Los Angeles on. And like, we just had a wedding. I got a bunch of like jobs and stuff. Not the only one that's really springing in mind now is when I worked in like haunted houses for, because we moved there in like September. And so for the month of October, I worked for a company that like went to very rich people's houses and set up haunted houses like in their garages.
Oh, like little pop-ups.
Yeah, little pop-up haunted houses.
Oh, that's...
And it was actually like my third haunted house job in my life.
Mm.
Yeah, and I hated it a lot. But what I wanted to create... thing. The problem is Justin and Griffin were still in West Virginia and Texas. And I was like, well, I can't do live shows regularly without them. And I don't have any properties that like I could go to somebody and say, hey, I want to pitch a show based off of this podcast I do. Because like my brothers weren't here and they weren't interested at that time. And so I was like, I need to create some shows that are with people that, A, I'm in the same city as, so that we can like do stuff together, and B, that I'm kind of creating on my own and developing my own identity as a performer instead of just being seen as a package deal of the McRoy brothers. What I did not do, which I should have done, is spent a lot of time developing like the perfect next thing. Instead, it was like I would meet someone who I'd be like, I really like you and I think you're cool, and I kind of had this passing idea for a podcast, so let's start doing it today. And that's how I started doing way too many, instead of like focusing on like one. But basically, I had gone from having a full-time job more than at the Shakespeare Company, where some weeks I was putting in like 80-90 hours and like sleeping on the couch at the theater for like 4 hours and going back to work, to then just doing podcasting. So it's suddenly like I'm feeling of all this time on my hands. What am I even doing? I am, you know, why did I move to LA? Am I being productive? What is happening? What is going on? And so I wanted to fill the time. And so I focused on quantity rather than quality. And I think if I could do it all again, I would hate to say I would do it differently, because I had a lot of fun doing those shows with people. And like, I still do Schwanners, and I just recently stopped doing Trends Like These. And like Bunker Buddies, I had to stop doing when I moved. And like Can I Pet Your Dog, that's another one that I had to stop doing when I moved. If I could do it differently, I think I probably would have gone back and really spent some time developing. Man, if I could do it differently with the knowledge I have now, I would write like a narrative, single voice, you know, like storytelling show, and like something that was just me that I can control and all that stuff. But I also wish I could go back in time and say, hey, you will reach a point where people will be excited to have you on their thing, without like having to develop this quote individual personality of Travis McRoy. Because at the time, what I wish I had known is like all of that comes from like connections you make and like networking you do, and someone saying like, you're fun to hang out with, we want you to be a panelist on this thing, and not like because you are seen as an individual or whatever, right? I've gotten more work being like asked to guest on something or being a talking head or something because it was like somebody that I did a panel at a convention with, or that I met at like a party that someone I knew was throwing, and then they're like, you are great, come on this thing, and not because they were a huge fan of my work.
Yeah, like literally by being nice and kind to people, rather than like
right.
trying to prove that you're not the Garfunkel or something.
Right, exactly. Exactly that. But what I thought was like, I'm only seen as a package deal. That's why I'm not getting asked to do things, because if I can't bring my brothers with me, they don't want just me. When the answer is like, people just didn't know me. Right? Like it's really easy, and this is something I don't know who needs to hear this, but maybe somebody does. It's really easy to confuse like having an audience with thinking you are well known in the industry. But especially nowadays, when everything is so, there's so much content in the world, that there are like hugely popular shows that if you take like one step to the left and ask this person if they know about it, they're like, I have no idea what you're talking
fully
about.
Fully, yeah. I mean, what do you care about more though?
What I care about as far as like being a creatively fulfilled and thinking is the audience, of course. Like I adore, it's the most cliche thing in the world, but I really do love my audience very much. And it's why I love going to conventions and love doing it. And I miss it so much right now, Kevin. It's like the face-to-face time of like talking to people is my fuel, and it makes me very happy. And our audience has always been so good to us and so supportive to us. Is like, yeah, it's that. But as far as like now, I have a family that I have to support, and I do not know what the tail of podcast career looks like. You know, I don't know. Is this like, yeah, you're living off those podcast proceeds well into your 70s. Like, I don't know, right? And so I'm trying to build a career, and that takes diversifying the portfolio and reaching, because that's the thing is, I don't want to be making my brother and me when I'm 62.
That was going to be my question, is like, yeah, because there is such lack of precedent as far as, yeah, this is how long you do a show, unless it's like right. A discrete seasons for 10 episodes of an investigative podcast. There's not really like, and then you stop unless right. It is dictated by format.
And think about this, right? We've been going for a 10 years, right? And if you put that in terms of like a TV show, this is 10 seasons, right? So if podcasting was like TV shows, right, we'd be in syndication, we'd be living off residuals for the rest of our lives, we'd be asked to appear as guests on things, we could make a paycheck anytime we wanted to by like going to a convention or being a guest part on a TV show, right? But that's not how podcasting works. Once you stop doing it, you stop getting paid for it. So it's different from like albums, movies, like books, all of this stuff where the tail on it is like you keep making money on it as long as people are buying the thing.
Yeah, there's not really such a thing as passive income with this stuff.
Right. So that's when I realized like I need to make sure that I am having the type of career that people are like, oh, we're working on this project. Oh, you know who would be fun to have on it? Travis. Right. Not like Travis is so popular right now that we'd be dumb not to have him on it, which is how I used to think it worked. But like the fact of the matter is like Paul F. Tompkins is an incredibly talented comedian and actor and all those things. Right. And I always get excited when I see him in something or hear his voice in something. So what I'm about to say is not to take away from his talent at all. But people love him. The people who work with him, the people who are his friends, love Paul F. Tompkins. And that is why he's in everything. You know what I mean? Like, he's talented. So they know that they're getting talent, right? So that's what makes it so easy to say yes. But you also have to think that it's people who are like, Paul will be fun to hang out on set. It will be good to have Paul F. Tompkins in it. We will be happy that Paul F. Tompkins is here. You know, and like, if you're super, I remember a casting director in college saying to me, like, everyone who goes into an audition, you have to think most of them are talented. Maybe not everyone, most of them are talented. And so what they're more often than not looking for is who is talented and will be fun to hang out at the after party. And like, that's the thing is like, the rare exception tends to be like, white actors who are seen as incredibly handsome and talented, and so they can act like assholes, right? And for some reason, they fucking keep working. But most of the time, it's like, yeah, if you're nice, that's way better. Like, you gotta be talented and fun and talented, and your company is desirable. And so anyways, that long way to say, as I started all of those other podcasts, I was doing the editing on them myself, because with my brother and me and the Adventure Zone for a long time, it was Griffin doing it. And so, but with all the other ones that I started, I was editing it. So I was listening to my voice over and over and over again. And I was able to kind of disassociate from it and not really think about it. People have asked me this before, like when you're editing, do you ever like start to feel like that's not funny, that thing I said, or oh, I sound so dumb? And I'm like, no, because I'm not listening to myself. I'm like listening to Travis, the podcaster, speaking on the thing, the character of that person is talking, and I'm the editor now, and I have no control over what he said, so I can't think about it in those terms. Like, I can't get caught up listening to my own voice, or else I'm not doing a very good job editing.
Yeah, you almost have to invent the fiction of I'm an audience member cutting this together.
Right.
This is what I want to hear. More so than like, I got to protect myself and be
right.
The best. It's like, well, what's the better experience for someone who I don't know?
Well, and also, I mean, if I'm not going to lie, I wish I don't know. Maybe I wish I was more evolved in this, but the fact that people like listening to my show also did a lot to help my self-confidence in my voice. Because I was like, well, I guess if my voice was that bad, they wouldn't be listening. Like, you know, so it's like that. There's something about when we started working on the My Brother and Me TV show, our showrunner and dear, dear friend J.D. Amato got me and Justin and Griffin, all three engraved compasses that all said professional comedian. And the reason being is like, you are professional comedians. Like, you have to trust that now and trust that you know what you're doing and know where you're going and know what you're saying. Because, like, the three of us, our tendency for a long time when people are, like, either using the word comedian or professional, we'd be like, And after a while, and that's coming from me, a guy with sometimes heaps and heaps of self-confidence and sometimes not, but normally heaps and heaps of self-confidence. And it's like, yeah, but no, there are comedians out there. And it's like, yeah, but you're a comedian. Are you like, I exist primarily on a career built on making comedy. And it's like the same thing as like with the Adventure Zone now is like a big part of my career is storytelling and writing. And it's like, I'm a New York Times bestselling author, but if someone's like, you're a writer, right? I'm like, I wrote, and it's like, yes, I am, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to humbly own that without it sounding like a, whatever, like a sort of spin or manipulation of what you actually feel, like sometimes in the context of a humble brag, but it's hard to be like, yes, it's just like the age old thing of you, it's really difficult to accept the compliment sometimes.
Well, that's the thing, is when someone's like, you're an author, it's like, that's not how I think of myself. Like, I think of myself, if someone said, you're a writer, I'd be like, yes, I have written The Adventure Zone now for a while, and we wrote these books, then like, yes. But if someone's like, you're an author, for some reason, connotation-wise mm-hmm. is different to me. I'm like, nah, I don't really consider myself that way. But my favorite, one of my favorite jokes that Justin has ever said, or I guess maybe just one of the truest things, is the worst thing about being a New York Times number one best-selling author is anytime someone says that you're a New York Times best-selling author, you're legally required to say number one best-selling author.
Yes, that is a legal requirement. It's weird that they passed that law, but
I know, right?
I'm kind of glad they did because it's good for everyone's confidence. Let's take a break from Travis's weird voice and we'll be right back with more Inside Voices.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Inside Voices. And now here's the rest of my conversation with Travis. One thing I think about a lot, and especially with you and your family, but something I think about for myself and for other people is this idea of this is sort of a Christian term, but it is the idea of stewardship. So it's like you've been given this, you've achieved this or gained this through hard work and kismet and this alchemy and XYZ happening, and then kind of facing the questions of how do you steward those things well along the way. So especially as someone with a family, while also trying to do these things that sometimes feel antithetical to family, which is like, and like the privacy concerns of having a family, which is like sort of transparency and being yourself and giving of yourself in these kind of like vulnerable spaces. How do you feel like you steward your audience and the
how's
attention
my walk?
That you've been
is
getting?
That what you mean?
How's your
my
walk? How's your walk how's and walk? How's your heart? Yes.
How's your heart? Well, to answer your question, I mean, that is a tough balance, you know? Like I've been in this game now for over a decade, mm-hmm. Kevin.
But it didn't feel like stewardship at the beginning is the thing.
No, not at all. At the beginning, I think at that point, I was way more open. The thing is like a big turning point in this is when Teresa was pregnant with Bibi, with my first daughter. And like Teresa and I had a conversation about like, are we going to post pictures of her online? Are we going to like show her face? You know, much like a lot like the kind of humble brag humility thing we were just talking about, there's a part of you who wants to say like, I do not think I am important enough that I really have to worry about that. It's like deciding where you want to live. You know what I mean? It's like it's what's right for you and your family. And for me, I'm willing to share so much of myself with my audience and with the world and talk about things that for my own mental health, for my family's safety, and for BB's privacy, it's like there has to be things. And you know, the weird thing is like, you talk about stewardship, and that's something I think about a lot. Because one of the things that we kind of realized really, really early on in our podcasting and just in front of like having an audience is like a level of responsibility that like is a thing that makes me legit furious when I see other content creators not accepting or acknowledging or just and sometimes ignoring the responsibility that they have to an audience. And I don't mean like owing the audience something because they, you know, invested time or money or interest in you or whatever. I do think that there is some degree of that is true, but I mean more like doing the right thing and being somebody who can set a good example or does their best. I mean, I'm not fucking perfect. Like, I screw up all the time. And now I'm 36. There is no way I have my finger on the pulse of, like, I know exactly what the right thing culturally to be pushing and saying and stuff right now. I'm trying, but there is no way. And, like, give me 4 years and I'll be so far out of touch. Not on purpose, but that'll happen. But I do my best, and I see a lot of creators out there not doing that and sometimes actively shit-stirring to get more attention or, like, catering to a angrier, seedier, worse element to grow their audience or grow their product or whatever. And that to me is just so disgusting.
Yeah, well, I think what we're getting at and kind of alluding to and something you've probably experienced in the last 10 years is sort of the positive flip side of what some people would deem cancel culture, but the idea of correction culture or the ability and capacity for people to learn and grow along the way.
Dude, I've seen so many mostly white dudes, but different people in entertainment industry. But like the ones I'm thinking of now are like specifically like comedians where like they make some kind of joke or they make some kind of thing and it pisses people off, rightly so. But then there's this other side of their audience is like, nah, fuck them, man. You're great. Speaking truth to power. Don't let them censor you. Oh, these libs, right? And they make the decision to lean into those people. And they're like, yeah, these are the real people that support me. And these are the real people, you know, like, yeah, you're right. And like, there is this like, it's the dark side, right? It's the dark side of the force where it's like, Like you feel all this support and you feel your audience might even grow the shittier you become. Because there are people who are like, yeah, you tell it to them.
Do you feel like you had to confront that? Like a sort of fork in the road like that, where it's like you could lean into the worst impulses or not?
I don't remember ever having to make that decision. And that's not me saying like, I'm such a great guy, I never even considered it. It's more like I just felt guilty and bad and didn't want people to be mad at me.
Sure.
Like I've seen that happen with no kind of like acknowledgement of like, listen, I know I'm making the world a worse, angrier, more hateful place to grow my audience and sell tickets. And like, that's so clearly what they're doing. And so, yeah, for me, it's like there have been plenty of times in the last 10 years where I have fucked up. And somebody will say like, hey, you fucked up. Now, some people will say it in a way that is difficult to listen to.
This is speaking, maybe you said something insensitive or something that might have been hurtful to a person.
Or ignorant. Yes,
or
correct.
Or ignorant. Okay.
And sometimes it is said in a way that perhaps is not constructive or is difficult to listen to. But there is also plenty of people who are like, hey, you might not have known or whatever. They have done a lot of emotional labor to give me a chance to be better. Then there are also plenty of people, once again, I think people who maybe are well-intentioned, who are like, don't let the haters get you down. And also people like, they're fucking oversensitive, blah, 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 right? Look at it this way, right? Because sometimes when you talk about like culture and stuff, it can seem pretty subjective. But if we were talking about like an objective thing, right? If I was spelling a word wrong, if I was doing math wrong, and there was somebody like, hey, just so you know, actually, the answer to that math problem is this. And there are people like, ignore them. You can do math wrong if you want to. Fuck that. It's like, why would I listen to the people telling me to just keep doing it wrong? And so, like, that's kind of my thing, is like, me learning how to do something better costs me nothing except acknowledging that I messed up. And that seems to be what the shitty people, other entertainers that I have no respect for, refuse to do, is that they sit there and go like, okay, well, if that person's right, then I was wrong. And that makes me feel bad. So rather than me feel bad, I will just say that they're wrong so that I don't have to be wrong. And like, that is a self, like, kind of not just a self-fulfilling prophecy, but like a self-strengthening cycle, where like the more you say, if they are right and I am wrong, then I am bad. But I refuse to acknowledge that I am bad, and so they are wrong. And the more you do that, the harder it becomes for someone to be like, wait, maybe I am wrong. And maybe it's because it is like become this like triumvirate hive mind of me and Justin and Griffin, of like, we share discussions about that. That like, you know, in those early days when we would do something that upset people, that was ignorant, that was, you know, insensitive, and someone would say something, you always had the impulse to be like, I didn't do anything wrong because I'm a nice guy. And so it's very helpful to have like two other human beings who are like, well, let's talk about it before we address it. And like, here's the thing, I've fucked up recently with like not with something like being insensitive or ignorant or so, but like responding to criticism and this like, no, you know what? You're wrong. And like that like unreceptive kind of attitude is just not, it's not who I want to be, but it is a very easy person to kind of fall into, right? Because like, you want to be a good person. And there are two ways to feel like a good person. And one is hard work and education and continuing to like to strive to fix your mistakes. And the other way is to tell yourself you're a good person already. And that one is way easier.
Yeah, shore up, denial, isolate.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like, I think that there's a reason that it is so easy for people who fuck up to just fall back on, well, I think you're wrong for being upset about it, because it seems like a subjective thing, right? But I have found a lot more personal growth and self-respect from going the other way. And it's hard. I mean, there's still leaving yourself open to feedback like that is like trying to, it can be really, really difficult, right? Because like, if you think about it, like building a sieve, right? The first person to invent a sieve, right, was like, how porous can I make it and it still holds together, right? Because I want to let water through, but if the rocks come through, that sucks. And so that's the difficult thing, is you're trying to build a mesh that lets constructive feedback and things that you should improve on through, while keeping out the people who just want to yell at you or have their own personal agenda or dislike you because of who you are.
Yeah.
You know, like I'll never forget when we started the My Brother and Me TV show, the day it went up, like we put out the first episode and somebody tweeted at me, I created this Twitter account to tell you how much I hate your glasses. I was just like, what? And like that kind of thing of like, I can't let that kind of thing
land. That feels easy to not internalize.
Right,
yeah,
right, that's
not
exactly.
An honest conversation. But some of this stuff, you do wonder if there is like the constructive, positive way of, because they say like, oh, don't internalize criticism, don't internalize negativity, but I do wonder if there are like positive constructive ways of like internalize criticism in the technical sense of that word, where it's like, if this can construct something within you by internalizing it. And it sounds like you're at least trying to do that.
I'm doing it right now. Yesterday I had a long conversation. I'm not joking. Yesterday I had a Twitter interaction talking about like the current arc of Adventure Zone, which I'm working on. And we're on like episode, we're about to record episode 15 this week. And so like early on got a lot of, not backlash, that's not, there are people who didn't like it. You know, it's a new series. It's different from the ones we've done before. And so like I shut it out more or less. I would still look at it. Like because I am me, I would seek it out. I'd like go read forums and Reddit and Twitter about it every week, but I would not internalize it. I would just see it, get angry about it, and then close the page, right? I'd read it, say like, these people don't know what they're talking about, and close the page. And I realized that in doing that, and I realized this yesterday, that in doing that, I had not left myself open to the possibility that perhaps I could be constantly improving the thing I was doing, right? Is that I had not left myself open to the possibility that maybe what I was doing was not perfect. And so I've spent like the last 36 hours doing kind of whatever the opposite of a cleanse is, where I've been like compacting all of this feedback that people have been emailing me and reading it and trying to filter out the chunks of like, that is a good idea, I should be doing that, and not internalizing it in terms of I am doing a bad job and they are right and I'm horrible at this, but more of like, I am not perfect and this is a journey and you should be trying to improve everything over time. And if I deny the fact that I might be doing something wrong, I will not improve.
This so reminds me of kind of a Damon Lindelof philosophy he had, which is he, and there's been points in his career where he's been very online, but there was when The Leftovers came out and season one got pretty heavily criticized by great television writers like Matt Zoller-Seitz or Andy Greenwald or Emily Nussbaum, he ended up taking it all in and then internalizing in a way where Leftover season two was such a positive corrective that it was heralded as one of the best TV seasons ever. And his thought process on it, and when he talked about it, was, I have this free resource of feedback from these like really smart, like in this case, these like television and film writers that I really respect a lot and I would read anyway, even if it wasn't about my own stuff. So why wouldn't I try to tap into that as like a sort of resource of like, okay, let's see, maybe there's something to this.
Right. I've said this forever about like the careers of some pretty famous like comedians and writers and stuff, where it's like, you will see in a person's career where they get so popular and so famous that people stop pushing back, stop like saying like, that is not a good idea. And the work they start doing sucks. Like their comedy becomes too big, or their scripts are incomprehensible or whatever, because there was not somebody saying like, we need to cut this scene because this is terrible. And it's like suddenly they're only playing the biggest thing the whole time. And they're like doing cheap jokes or like, you know, like tropey stories or whatever, because there wasn't someone going, we're going to edit that. Like, we won't film this. I'm like, I don't ever want to get to that point. Like, that, I hate that idea. It's like, it's not even resting on laurels. It's like assuming that you are famous because you are perfect and not because you were receptive to feedback and like worked hard and like didn't take it for granted that you were doing a good job and all these things. And so, yeah, I literally, like, before we got on this call, well, I was napping, but before that, I was like going, I took out a notebook and just started writing down like things I could be doing better based off of like feedback I was getting and like things I was kind of taking for granted in the story. And what's funny is before this, I was actually feeling pretty creatively like despondent, where I was just like, what am I even doing? I don't think people like this. I'm working really hard and for what? And since kind of opening myself up to the idea of perhaps there are actionable things I could be working on and improving, it has given me more creative energy and a new fire to be like, what if I was like actually building on this instead of just continuing this through line of story I was telling? What if I was improving the process as well and like working on these things and improving myself and improving my abilities and not just staying at this level forever?
And it sounds like, yeah, if you apply more of a problem solver mentality to it, and like, it's almost like a getting things done philosophy of like, if it's just like very simple tasks, then that like mm-hmm. those link together to be a much more interesting endeavor.
I've used this word a lot, but I mean, it's what art is, and it's like subjective, right? Because the thing is if I was building a machine and the machine didn't work, right, I would know that the machine didn't work and I would have to fix something within the machine. But telling a joke, telling a story, writing a script, you can't say like, it is mechanically not working, so I know something needs to be fixed. You can look at it and think, this works perfectly. And someone else looks and like, that is not working.
Right, it's like cooking. It's more like, oh, right. Maybe this needs oregano. Oh, maybe it's garlic, actually. I don't know.
But even that is like, sometimes if you bite into something you've cooked and it's terrible, everyone will acknowledge it's like, yes, this is universally bad. But sometimes you write a script and you're like, I killed it. And there are people who are like, this is bad. And you're like, no, I killed it. This is great. You know what I mean? And so it's like that kind of thing of like, but it is difficult because the other side of this is maybe I'll work really hard and I'll spend the next like 4 days like completely rethinking everything. We'll record the next episode and then it will go out and then people will be like, worst one yet. And it's like, well, then do I internalize that? Because I felt good about, like, it's tricky, right? Because it is, there is never a point at which you're like, and done growing. But I'd rather just quit doing it than turn into this, like, fuck all these sensitive whiny babies. I'm going to make the thing I like. Like, I would just stop doing it before I did that.
Well, and on that subject, because you did talk about, like, a quantity versus quality thing at the earlier part of the conversation, and this idea of doing things that just give you joy and the things that are still jobs and still create revenue for yourself, but the things that you most care about. For you, when you do think about like the next 30 or 40 years, is it always podcasts, or do podcasts just happen to be the best container for your thing right now?
Well, the good news is like the three shows that I regularly continue to do now are with my brothers, my dad, and my wife. And so like, I just like talking to them. The trickiest one is Schmanners, but that's only because we're raising two kids now. And so like finding a time where it's like, and we both can sit in a room without them for 45 minutes is tough. But otherwise it's like, I don't ever want to stop talking to my brothers. I don't ever want to stop talking to my dad. I don't ever stop talking to my wife. And so I enjoy doing those. But I like the idea of being a kind of overall performer who gets to be in more things and do more stuff. And I like writing the graphic novels. I like being in movies. We just did that. That was great. I like being on TV. That's wonderful. I'd like to do more of that. I just like to, I like to be a performer. I like performing and I want to perform more.
Well, I think it's going to happen. I think it has happened too. And that's what's so extraordinary is like being able to like reverse engineer these like audio things like Trolls 2 or to make my brother into a TV show eventually.
Yeah, dude, it's weird. Weird as hell.
Yeah, like
it
your
is,
voice.
It's not... Yeah, it's not a career trajectory that I would recommend to anyone.
Yeah, that's the thing about careers like yours and your brother's. It's like it worked that one time, and that's why it can't work again. Because
you can't be like, you know what? I dream of getting into voiceover work in animated movies. So what I'm going to do is have a podcast for 10 years.
Well, Travis, buddy, I like your weird voice. I like your flamboyant voice. I like it all, and I love you.
Hey, I love you too, Kevin. Thank you for talking to me.
Hey, thanks for doing the show.
Should we start recording?
Yeah, I'm good to go now. Travis McElroy has a weird voice, and you can listen to that voice on My Brother and Me, The Adventure Zone, or Schmanners, wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I don't know where you get your podcasts, but I'd love if you tell me, and I think it would really bond us together as friends. Inside Voices is produced by me and Steve Allman. Our theme music is by Pam Autori. And I'm your host, Kevin T. Porter. Thanks for spending time with us today on Inside Voices. And please, at least for now, stay inside.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.